The Athletic.
Totally Football Show. In today's seasonal special, here comes Santo. After Steve Cooper falls in a forest firing, we look at the advent in Nottingham of Nuno Espirito Santo. Elsewhere, Jeddah force push Man City into the final at the Club World Cup. There's shootouts galore back home in the League Cup quarterfinals, plus a whole weekend of action too, why coin tosses will be key, and some spare punditry in case you need for things that may happen while we're off over Christmas. All that and more in this Totally Football Show. Yeah, listener, it's December the 20th, and it's the last Totally Football Show of the year. Don't worry, it's not a busy time for football or anything like that. And we have for you a very special, timeless year-ender of a podcast for you today, featuring Tim Spears and his new haircut.
Hi, James.
Hi, Tim. Also, Duncan Alexander's here with us.
Hello.
All right, Duncan. And 2003's Mr. Perfect, Tom Williams.
No.
Hello, James. Not my words, but those of Moore Magazine.
God, how I wish I hadn't shared that story with you.
But part of you obviously wanted it to be known.
No, it was germane to what we were talking about.
I don't recall how it was germane to what we were talking about. Anyway, what are we talking about, Tom? You were in a magazine feature.
So, you know, we were talking about minor brushes with celebrity when we were at university.
Yes.
And I thought,
on account of the fact that Duncombe was at college with the Dust Brothers, the Chemical Brothers, nay, the Dust Brothers, yeah.
And that you had your first brush with the limelight, James, when you were at university.
In university, yeah, on Crime Watch.
I thought it would be germane to the conversation to mention that I once appeared in a magazine.
Yes.
in a magazine aimed at teenage girls, and it was all about you write in and or you phone in and you can date one of the men profiled in the magazine.
Yeah.
And I somehow ended up being one of those men, and
so modest.
Yeah, and no, it was. I thought it would make me
Is
look
it
quite
true?
Cool.
You did
but
the photo shoot sitting on another boy's knee.
I'm really not sure I'm prepared to go into this level of detail.
All right.
There was a photo shoot. It was confusing. Yeah. And then I was given a phone number to call up to listen to there weren't that many, but the voicemails of the...
like, say, Piers Morgan, but, you know.
Listen to the voicemails that had been left to request a date with me, and the date did not materialise, and that was that.
All right, but people did. It's not like they didn't leave you messages, Tom. You just went, yeah, this is not such a great idea. And yeah, I salute you for that. Excellent.
Yes, yeah, some of them sounded a bit strange.
Mm. Tim, did you have a collegiate brush with celebrity?
No,
all right,
absolutely then. Not. No, there were no celebrities in Nottingham, unfortunately.
Okay. All right.
I can think of.
Thank you for that, Tom. Thank you for sharing that. It's nice to get a smile back on our faces after the downer that was this morning's announcement that Nottingham Forest have moved on from the beloved Steve Cooper and chosen Nuno Espirito Santo as his replacement. Isn't it exactly a huge surprise? We've had Daniel Storey literally every podcast saying they're going to fire Steve Cooper. But still, what a moment for Forest and their fans. Nick Miller writing a lovely piece on The Athletic, calling Cooper Forest's second most important manager in their history. The man who took Forest from pity to joy. Why? What's so special? Oh, look, Nick Miller joins us now. Hello, Nick.
Oh, hello, James.
Hello. Handy that you're here. Go on, then. For anyone outside the Forest fam, what is it that makes this not just another managerial firing?
Oh, God. Well, I mean, getting Forest promoted for the first time in 23 years, that was...
They were in last place when he took over?
They were in last place. They'd won one game in the first 8 or 9 of the season when he arrived. It looked pretty bleak at that point. And then with kind of more or less the same set of players, only just missed out on automatic promotion, then went up in the playoffs. So, yeah, winning a lot of games certainly helps.
Mm.
But he scored pretty high on the kind of he just gets it scale. And he was just a good...
What did he get?
Well, he always knew the right things to say to get fans on side. And he was just a good guy. There was loads of stories about him, you know, just taking time to talk to supporters. If you've ever seen games at the City Ground, you'll have seen the big kind of banners and tifos or whatever that are in the Trentland, the group that do those, they spend a lot of time at the stadium. They'll be there kind of long into the night, and they would very often find, as they were trudging out into the car park at the end of the evening setting up these things, Steve Cooper to just kind of thank them and shake their hand and take a picture. And, you know, he didn't, it's just kind of the kind of thing that you don't need to do if you're a Premier League manager and you've got lots else on. But he did, and he, you know, beloved in the city.
Nick, you're one of a gaggle or perhaps a spinny of Forest fans.
Here a spinny?
Perhaps. What's some kind of arboreal conglomerate?
It's one up from a copse.
Yeah. Okay. Is it, though? You'd have more trees in a spinny, would you, than a copse?
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't think I've ever heard that word, but how do you spell spinny?
A spinny. S-P-I-N-N-E-Y.
Yeah.
I'm going.
It goes
a spinny.
Copse, spinny, wood, spinny, forest.
And if wood you think is of a field,
smaller
then
than a forest.
A group of trees.
I guess that figures.
Oh yeah, wood is definitely.
He's just
than
one centre
forward
there.
I didn't know there was anything between copse and wood.
Oh, a copse is a small cluster of trees, generally in the middle of a field, I think, with a lot of expanse around it.
You
but
often
anyway,
find often hanged people in copses.
Did they
in medieval times? Yeah, if you see a copse outside a village, it's usually where people were hanged.
Damn,
this has taken a turn, hasn't it? Jesus.
Yeah. Okay. But anyway, another Forest fan is Matt Davis Adams, who responded to the club's statement, to wit, "We thank Steve for his dedication and commitment. He'll always remain a friend of the club and will forever be welcome at the City Ground. We wish him well in his future endeavours." Matt says, "Let's see how welcome he is in March when his Palace team sends us down and Nuno's replacement gets future endeavoured as a consequence." Matt's had a bit of form with predictions, so what do you make of that?
Has it right, Matt? Is Matt just kind of milking this Bournemouth prediction?
It was a great prediction.
It was great. It was a phenomenal.
What do you make
prediction
of this one, Nick?
Steve Cooper at Crystal Palace could very easily happen. We'll have to go pretty disastrously wrong for Nuno's replacement to be in place by then.
Although, as you mentioned, the dismissal of Steve Cooper just before the year end means that. Can you quote the stat at me? Because I clearly can't remember it exactly.
Yeah, 2022 is the only year since 2010, the only calendar year in which Forest haven't sacked a manager, or at least changed a manager.
So 2010...
2010, Billy Davies was in charge, and he got the whole year.
Wow. 2011, they fired a manager.
Yeah.
2012, they fired a manager.
Let's see where we're going with this. Yeah. Then
the incident with the pigeon.
Who was the pigeon? I guess sort of... Dougie Friedman was probably the pigeon.
Possibly so. I'm sorry to be laughing.
It's okay, James. People are generally been treating me like there's been a death in the family this morning.
So you compared this actually to when Bielsa left Leeds, or, you know, was ousted at Leeds, and the fact that there were Leeds fans who would rather have gone down with him than survive without, as it turned out they got neither eventually. But
yeah.
What is that your feeling with Forest? And do you see that maybe the club, after one win in 13, would feel that a change was necessary?
Oh, I mean, logically, there are loads of arguments to say that, you know, even if you sort of discount the 5-0 defeat to Fulham a couple of weeks ago, loads of arguments to say, yeah, it's probably time, you know, both in terms of results and his relationship with the owner. Lots of logical arguments to say, yeah, it's not an unreasonable decision. And he was there for 2 years, which by the scale of things is a pretty decent run for a Premier League manager these days.
Yeah. Is there a simple explanation as to what went wrong for a manager who had performed such miracles in the Championship?
I think probably he kind of made a few mistakes. He's fallen out with a couple of players, which is a sign that he'd maybe lost a little bit of the grip on things, because that's one of his strengths was his relationship with the players.
Right.
It kind of, because Forest didn't quite sign 29 players in the summer, they still signed 13. They're still basically a new team. Two goalkeepers who haven't turned out to be very good and various other players. So signing 40-odd players in 2 years, you can figure that out once, but figuring it out twice... Mm. Might be a bit of an issue, and it's not all that. Cooper's made some mistakes as well, but yeah. In answer to the kind of original thing, I think there is an element of the support that would have just kept him for as long as he wanted to be there. But logically, there were, as I said, plenty of reasons to make a change.
Well, it's one thing to get rid of Steve Cooper. It's perhaps quite another to appoint Nuno Espirito Santo in his place. Nuno, who was out of work after being dismissed by Saudi Arabian club Al-Ittihad early in November, rumours he'd fallen out there with Karim Benzema, but had previously won the title. Before that, he had that brief but so special 17-game spell at Spurs. And before that, he did amazing things himself at Wolves, leading them up and keeping them there for three seasons. You got an FA Cup semi-final, consecutive seven-place finishes. Place finishes, rather. I'm looking at you, Tim, because you're the Wolves fan here. So people have a view on Nuno Espirito Santo. What's your take from a Wolves perspective?
Yeah, I think a lot of people's views come from that 17-game spell at Spurs. And yeah, it was bad, but it wasn't a disaster. I mean, they were like seventh place when he got sacked. And there were huge sort of mitigating circumstances in why that was never going to work. He was like 20th choice, if people remember, for the job. And they had Harry Kane wanting to leave that summer and all sorts of difficulties. But if you look at every other club he's been at, he's had success at the majority of them. You know, you talk about comparisons with Bielsa leaving Leeds. I mean, when Nuno left Wolves, it was like very similar. He was adored across the whole city. The people were in tears for his last game because it was announced before his last game that he was leaving. He was in tears. The players were in tears. You know, the impact he had. You know, you talk about Cooper taking Forest to heights they haven't seen in decades. Well, he did that at Wolves for sure. He also did it at Rio Ave right at the start of his career. He took them into Europe for the first time in their history. So I think the Spurs job was too big for him for a number of reasons, but Forest is a better sized club for him, but it's not a better sized squad. He does like a small squad and he doesn't like to be challenged, I would say. You mentioned Benzema. There were issues at Wolves. If there were sort of egos or players causing a bit of trouble, they would just be out the door and he'd keep a very tight group of players together. And of course, the other difference at Wolves was he sort of started from scratch in the Championship and built a team of Mendes signings from scratch. That's not going to happen here. It's going to have a huge squad. And obviously, the fans are going to have very little patience for him, I would guess, coming off the back of Cooper. But it's the players who count, really. That's an interesting one to me. Do the players feel the same as the fans? Do they adore Cooper as much, or were they...
Some of them, yeah. In terms of the players, the interesting ones are going to be Morgan Gibbs-White, who was Forest's most important player last season, has been not good this season, but you know, not many of the players have been good this season. But I believe had a bit of falling out with Nuno at Wolves. So, you know, I imagine that, well, hopefully both sides are sort of pragmatic enough to kind of try and figure that out. But it's going to be really interesting to see what actually happens there.
Mm-hmm. He's been Manager of the Month in Premier League as many times as Jose Mourinho. So,
which is not very many. Because
well, four times, only 15 managers more ever. Okay.
Because Jose's always...
It's going to be fine.
Thanks, Duncan. It is reassuring. I sent Tim a series of slightly more intense than I intended messages yesterday.
Yeah, did we get quite intense, didn't we?
Asking for reassurance that everything was going to be okay.
Did you receive that?
I did, yeah. It was very reassuring. I'm going to, next time I have any kind of personal crises, I'm going to get in touch with Tim just to calm me down and stroke my hair and tell me everything's going to be fine.
Did he use any reassuring emojis?
No emojis. No, just
he's the real Mr. Perfect.
Yeah.
All right.
Magnus, all right, well, best of luck. Do read Nick's piece if you've got a strong constitution, because it'll reduce you to a blubbering wreck. And
like all the best Christmas content. It tugs at the heartstrings. Exactly. It reminds you of the important things. And, you know, sometimes if you've got a difficult family member, you just need to kick them out of the house.
It's the kind of, it's the sports writing equivalent of It's a Wonderful Life. Isn't
exactly.
It?
Yeah.
And it's got Lara Taylor in it. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Nick, Merry Christmas to you.
Happy Christmas, everyone.
Lovely.
God bless us.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Nick Miller there, chatting about the new look Forest. Saturday, 3 o'clock, their game with Bournemouth. What else is happening this weekend in the Premier League? Well, there are only 9 fixtures because Man City's game with Brentford is postponed because City are currently on the other side of the world preparing for their club World Cup final against Fluminense. The rest of the Premier League will be doing thusly. Thursday night, the round begins with Crystal Palace against Brighton. Friday sees Villa against Sheffield United. Saturday, the 23rd of December, West Ham take on Man United. That's the early game. Then at 3 o'clock, you've got Spurs-Everton, the aforementioned Forest-Bournemouth, Fulham against Burnley, and Luton-Newcastle. And then at 5:30, Liverpool-Arsenal. before, on Sunday, a very special Christmas Eve fixture. Wolves-Chelsea. Wolves-Chelsea, Tim. Tim's shaking his head. Then from Boxing Day, you've got another full round. Games on the 26th, 27th, 28th. Huh. Wow, what's going to happen over this Christmas? Will City get left behind while they're off in Saudi? Liverpool-Arsenal's the kind of key game from this cluster of matches, and it's Saturday 5:30, and it's second against first. Have the Gunners won at Anfield in the last 11 years?
No.
Will they this time?
Maybe.
All right then. Statistically, this is one of the goaliest fixtures out there, isn't that right?
Yeah, I mean, I think last weekend people got a bit excited about Liverpool Man United because of last season being 7-0 and thought, hey, we're in it. But historically, Liverpool United games have been
duds. Always duds.
Yeah, right. And it was kind of reassuring to see it go back to that. It was heritage. But Liverpool Arsenal, particularly Anfield, is, yeah, goal central. I mean, you know, they're the two teams with the most 90th minute winners in Premier League history. On numerous occasions, Liverpool have scored like three or four goals before half time in this fixture. It's it always tends to be this time of year, another completely random decision from the fixture computer, our friend there. So I once had to miss the second half of a really good version because I was seeing some Christmas lights, which was very disappointing. But I think it's a key game because you would think if Arsenal can win this, it's a statement. TM, but it's also with City not playing as well and stretching the gap even more. And I know that obviously Arsenal were top last season at Christmas and didn't quite make it, but it feels like this is a much more streetwise Arsenal who almost, they control games. They're not that exciting sometimes because they want that prize. They know it's there. And it does feel like this is the season where it is there for someone.
And it does feel a little bit, what's the time, Mr. Wolf, in the sense that City are away, backs are turned at the Club World Cup. They're already 5 points off the pace. They've not been playing very well, various injury issues, and there's an opportunity for Arsenal and Liverpool and Villa to eke out a bit of a lead before City return. And I think we all expect that at some point Guardiola's going to figure things out and City will go on one of those barnstorming runs of form. I mean, it's not a given. It's not guaranteed. Mm. But, you know, we've seen them do it so many times. And the fact we've got three teams up there who are all sort of at different stages of their evolution and all, you know, playing different kinds of football is really exciting.
Okay. Because it could be Arsenal top at Christmas. It could be Liverpool. It could even be Aston Villa, who will be facing Sheffield United Friday evening, prior, of course, to that game at Anfield. What do you think, Tim? How important is it to be top at Christmas?
Statistically, fairly, but not definitively.
Yeah, there's a weird thing where the last six times that a team's been top at Christmas and not won the title, three of them have been Liverpool and three have been Arsenal. So we're in familiar surroundings. And Villa, in fact, the last time they were top of Christmas under John Gregory,
of course.
They had the biggest ever falling away. They came sixth that season.
Good Lord.
So all three teams that could be top this Christmas have checkered histories with being top at Christmas. But each season is its own delight.
It's a weird time for a top two clash, though, Liverpool-Arsenal. You know, 2 days before Christmas. It feels like a mid-March, mid-April sort of encounter. Not.
I said a minute ago about the fixture computer. This is the seventh time that Arsenal and Liverpool have met in their final Premier League game before Christmas. So.
What are the odds?
Seventh time in ever?
Or ever in Premier League history.
Oh, okay.
In Premier League history.
Right.
So, and I guess that speaks more to the fact that we've rarely had a Liverpool and Arsenal in the title race scenario. But it is a good pre-Christmas treat normally, and I'm expecting similar.
Okay. Missing a couple of key figures from, was it last season's clash? Andy Robertson and Constantine Hatzakis.
Yes, the hench linesman.
Yeah. I mean, he might be involved, but you don't hear from him much these days.
Oh, good Lord. Was that already a year ago?
That was last season, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
That's the thing. You have a sort of like historically hench linesman who gets involved in argy-bargy with a reasonably high-profile Premier League player, but because there's so much stuff happening in the Premier League, that kind of thing, just you forget about it.
Madness. Who's got Arsenal for this?
Well, Liverpool have got this weird thing about other people not scoring goals. James Pearce highlighted it in The Athletic this week that Darwin Nunes hasn't scored in 10, Luis Diaz 1 in 8, Cody Gakpo 2 in 10, and Jota's injured. So it's, and obviously last week highlighted with some crazy stats from that game, 34 shots.
34,
is it?
Yeah.
I think only 4 or 5 games in Premier League history have had more shots than that goal.
They had 15 from outside the box, which is a lot. And it kind of spoke to that. I mean, it's a bit like the Chelsea slip game where Gerrard had, I think, 8 shots from outside the box after making the mistake, almost as if he was desperately trying to rectify
the Gerrard Messiah game.
Yeah.
So what do you take from that, Tim?
I take that Arsenal are in a good spot for this. I quite fancy them for an away win. But it does feel quite goaly. I know it's a bit of an easy prediction to make, but I do feel like if Arsenal score first, it could be a bit of a humdinger.
Ooh.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the two games Arsenal have lost this season are away to Newcastle, which had some controversy, away to Villa, which also had a bit of controversy, but both of those games, they could have won, they played quite well. They haven't really been outplayed at all this season. I think they're probably the only team in the Premier League that you can say that about. So, I mean, this is a massive test, because historically they are pretty bad at Anfield, but, you know, when Arsenal have won the league, 1989, for instance, Anfield has loomed quite in an important fashion, so it could be the same.
And I think Arsenal are playing better football than Liverpool at the moment. I think a feature of Liverpool's season has been sort of grinding out wins when they've not played particularly well. Obviously, didn't get the win against United despite, you know, dominating, but prior to that, scratchy late win away at Crystal Palace. You know, there are echoes of more successful seasons under Klopp when that's what they did, just managed to find a way in each of their games. Whereas I think with Arsenal, although they've had, you know, a few scratchy wins themselves, I think there's a feeling that things are slightly more cohesive in terms of the football. You know, very decent win against Brighton last weekend and preventing Brighton scoring, which very few teams succeed in doing. So yeah, finally poised.
Okay. Liverpool will be in action Wednesday night in the League Cup quarter-final against West Ham. So there's that. Aston Villa, their match against Sheffield United, you may recall as being the fixture in which goal line technology stopped working in 2020.
Just a sweep on top of the goalkeeper here, and he holds on. There was pressure put on him there by John Egan. Well, John Egan was asking the question, but Michael Oliver said no. And clearly, with the goal line technology, the watch would have vibrated and didn't.
It did look like he'd taken it over the line.
As Sheffield United scoring a goal, which wasn't validated, Villa thus getting a point for a 0-0 draw and staying up at the end of the season by a point, much the anger of Bournemouth, who went down instead.
Well, it was the first game back after in Project Restart after the COVID pause. So I think more people were watching Villa Sheffield United than might normally have been doing so, because right. we'd all watched our requisite number of Bundesliga games and were like, no, we need the Prem. Yeah, and it was obviously I think it's the only time that Hawkeye's not worked.
I was just thinking that. I can't think of any other examples when it's... It was because there was so many bodies.
Yeah,
in the
it was
goal
a great line. Week for the word occlusion, I think.
Yes,
I recall.
There
was a lot of occlusion.
Okay. But as a way of highlighting the distance that Villa have come now, madness to think of them even being anywhere near a relegation battle. There they sit, one point is it, or two? 2 points off the top
one
of the
point.
Table. 1 point off the top of the table. Well, Man City, while all of this is going on, are going to be on Sunday. No, it's Friday. Friday night. They're facing a Fluminense, the Copa Libertadores champions, having dispatched the Asian Champions League winners, Urawa Red Diamonds, on Tuesday. City coming alive after a fairly stilted first half. Did you catch any of this in Jeddah?
Yeah, I mean, City playing without Erling Haaland, who's also going to miss the final because of this foot injury that he's carrying. And so lined up with a slightly curious system, no strikers. And to begin with, Bernardo Silva was playing through the middle, but then he ended up out on the right. And it was this sort of rotating carousel of midfielders that included Phil Foden, Mateo Kovacic and Mateus Nunes, who were sort of breaking forward from deep. And it very quickly became an attack-defence exercise. Urawa Reds are sort of camped on the edge of their own box, and City are trying to find angles and channels and look like they weren't going to succeed until first half stoppage time, when Nunez puts in a cross from the right that a defender slides in for an own goal, and then that was it. And then they scored a really nice goal, actually. Mateo Kovacic running through and scoring. Bernardo Silva adds a third. I mean, it wasn't a tremendous advertisement for this tournament that is about to grow in size in a very big way in 2025, in that it was a huge mismatch in a half-empty stadium with no atmosphere on patchy pitch.
You say no atmosphere, but when they showed Haaland on the big screen, the crowd got excited. And then they showed Kevin De Bruyne, who...
He's got a new Jack Grealish haircut.
Yeah, had a kind of... It was quite
Grealish. It does suit him. It does
Did
suit him, I think. Yeah. Yeah. But a bit of a
a little bit
Sergio Giorgini.
Tim's just Googling it at the moment. Let's get Tim's reaction live to the Kevin De Bruyne. But yeah, unable to feature in this game or consequently the final, because you can't play in the final if you didn't feature in the semi-final. Those are the rules. But now very much back and ready to go when City return to the Premier
League. Which is a boost.
You feel that's positive news?
Yeah.
Yeah. Tim?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Check it out.
And he looks more German now all of a sudden. I don't know. What do you think? Interesting.
Okay. Very good. Well, that's the situation with the top three plus City. Next up, we'll talk about some more of the action on the way as we head into Christmas.
All right, listeners, Tony Evans here, host of Walk On, your dedicated Liverpool podcast from The Athletic. Myself, James Pearce and Simon Hughes will be here every week on Wednesday this season as we bring you all the news and views that you could possibly ever want from the club. And James brings you At The Match Pod after every Premier League game, and it's really good, you know. Listen for free wherever you get your podcasts, and don't forget to follow and subscribe so you don't miss a single episode.
We're sponsored for this episode of The Totally Football Show by Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform helping you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. It's your perfect teammate, the Sutton to your Shearer, the Heskey to your Owen, the Mane and Firmino to your Salah. Whether you're selling I Belong to Jimbo t-shirts or Max and Barry half and half scars, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify has got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, which is up to 36% better compared to other leading commerce platforms. Plus, you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star. And what's more, Shopify's award-winning 24/7 support is there to help your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Now, because you listen to The Totally Football Show, you can sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/totally, all in lowercase. So go to shopify.com/totally to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. That's shopify.com/totally.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
Everyone loves it on this day. Listen, we've got a whole bunch of them now to get you through the festive period. Yeah, come back and check these out on, say, Christmas Day or Boxing Day or Christmas Eve. Christmas Eve, for example, on this day in 2006, Les Reed sacked by Charlton. Brutal. Dickensian. In its timing.
Well, his Charlton had just lost to Wickham in the quarterfinals of the League Cup.
Oh, had they.
And
had
they. I feared for him after that game, given the reaction to that defeat.
Only 6 weeks after he took up that position at the Valley, he was replaced by Alan Pardew. Also binned on Christmas Eve, Thomas Tuchel at Paris Saint-Germain. Heartless. He joined Chelsea barely a month later and led them to the Champions League trophy that very same season. So a happy ending.
Like Kevin McAllister didn't get to spend Christmas in Paris.
That's so true. What about a Christmas day on this day? Something in 1965, perhaps. That was the last time that there was a Football League match played on December the 25th. Do you recall the fixture?
Blackpool-Blackburn.
Blackpool-Blackburn it was. The score was 4-2 to Blackpool. Watched by 20,851.
Decent.
It's not bad, is it?
Does that mean that no manager's been sacked on Christmas Day?
No, I don't think so.
The
Premier League always needs new twists.
What would be worse though, Christmas Day or your birthday, like Trevor Francis?
Yeah, but it's
well, if you,
By the way, also on Christmas Day, this one in 1957, a 17-year-old Jimmy Greaves scored 4 goals for Chelsea as they beat Portsmouth 7-4. Wow.
Because they used to pair...
Gave them a stuffing.
They did indeed. Yeah. Well, they used to pair the fixtures, didn't they? So the same teams would play Christmas Day and then Boxing Day. Just to avoid too much trouble. And sometimes you'd get like completely flipped scorelines. Your team would get an absolute pasting on Christmas Day and then get pasted in turn... Giving and receiving, very much the message of Christmas. Right, nice.
It's been a very tricky festive period, though.
Boxing Day returns.
This year, because the same people who would eulogise about those days, because football was better, obviously, but also have to find the strength to complain about a Christmas Eve game this year in the Premier League, because the game was gone. So it's quite a difficult balancing act for these
people.
We'll
come on to that Christmas Eve fixture and the problems therein very shortly, but we can't mention Boxing Day, Duncan, without talking about... Come on then. You love this.
I don't love it.
1963.
Yeah, it's a complete outlier.
Okay.
Again, in the kind of nostalgia fest that...
What happened in 1963?
Well, there were loads of goals. 66 goals, was 10 matches. Yeah, we've all seen the quite dated Sky screenshot that they made up the scores. But it's a complete outlier. People kind of use it wrongly. They kind of go, well, this is just what Christmas football was like.
Do they? I feel like they're just like, there were loads of goals on Boxing Day in 63.
They don't mention that Boxing Day 1919, the first round of the First World War, one of the lowest, at 1.2 goals per game. People don't go, oh, well, that just shows old football was rubbish. They only did it the other way around. So I think it needs to be... We need someone to score 10 goals in a game this Christmas.
Who's Fulham, your money on?
Not in the Forest under Nuno. I think he's gonna hit the ground running. But because obviously that Fulham scored 10 on Boxing, and that was the last time a top flight team has scored 10. Obviously we've come close recently.
That was the last time. That Boxing Day 1963. Ipswich, the victims, they got a consolation, scamp consolation, I would suggest. But 10-1 it finished.
Yeah, dangerous scoreline.
Fulham have scored, I think, 5 goals in each of their last Premier League fixtures. Yeah. So
they're warming up nicely.
Who are Fulham playing this weekend?
Burnley at home.
Yeah, there you go. It all adds up.
I've never seen you so sort of weary over a number or days.
I think it's too overused.
It's been too overused. Yeah, like all of us, when it first came out, I was like, wow, this is... But then every year, come on.
What about that Christmas Eve fixture this year, Tim? Wolves at home to Chelsea, Sunday at 1 o'clock, Christmas Eve. And it's Sky Sports.
Super Sunday.
To blame, they've moved this to Sunday so they can hang a thing on it.
Yeah, I mean, rightly, fans were annoyed because I guess you just don't.
But what's the difference?
You just don't expect it because it's been 1995 was the last one. So I guess they announced it 2 months ago, which does give people time. But obviously, people make plans for Christmas Eve, don't they?
Do they?
Festive travel is awkward.
So people love Boxing Day where there's no trains. Yeah. Christmas Eve when there are trains, that's bad.
You can have games on
Christmas Eve. Doesn't add up.
Just do your shopping. But what plans are you making on Christmas Eve? Midnight mass, perhaps. But I feel the game should be over by then.
Yeah, probably.
Not with VAR these days.
Stop his time these days.
Oof, we laughed, but you know. Both supporters' trusts have come out and condemned the scheduling of this fixture. As you say, it was done back in October. What about the game, though? What do you think? Wolves-Chelsea? What was that?
No, not particularly. Oh. They're normally quite low-scoring, dull affairs against Chelsea at home. So,
although Chelsea, who were in action midweek, of course, in that shootout win over Newcastle in the League Cup quarterfinals, did have 20 minutes or so from a certain Christopher Nkunku, which could see them solve one of their perennial issues, which is scoring.
Yeah, absolutely. Chances. And Wolves are in a bad run of form. Gary O'Neill could do with going on Monday Night Football again because the tide is starting to turn again. So that's what he did last time. He was very successful. Got him a couple of months in the bag. Wolves are in a bit of a poor run of form. So you'd fancy Chelsea for this one, I think.
Okay, will you be going along, Tim?
No, I won't. I am at Spurs-Everton... working on the 23rd.
Okay.
And then, won't have time to get back in time.
Won't have time.
But it's on telly, which is great.
Yeah.
So thanks, Sky.
Magnificent. All right. That was just one of the midweek League Cup quarterfinals. It was Tuesday evening at Stamford Bridge. Newcastle taking the lead early, Tom, through a bit of a defensive, I don't want to say howler, but it was a very unfortunate bit of play from, do pronounce his name for me.
Benoit Badiachil. Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, very curious game in that Chelsea dominated it pretty much from start to finish without really creating any chances. And Newcastle scored from their first foray into the Chelsea half when Callum Wilson picked up a loose pass from Levi Colwill, ran at Thiago Silva and Badiachil, kind of bundled his way through. And Badiachil got back in position really well and tried to sweep the ball away and out of danger and run it up the pitch and accidentally swept it against his own knee. And Callum Wilson ran in and expertly steered it home with the outside of his right foot. And then it became quite a remarkable spectacle because Newcastle just kind of almost gave up the ghost. They are running on fumes completely. And got so many injuries. Anthony Gordon limped off as well last night. They got players coming back and they got other players, you know, picking up knocks. And they didn't really offer anything at all as an attacking force. And so Chelsea completely dominated possession, got the ball in loads of really good areas and created almost nothing. Conor Gallagher had a shot against the bar early on. Sterling had a shot saved by Dubravka towards the end. And Nkunku came on for his Chelsea debut, back from his knee injury, and looked quite lively. Mudryk came on, bust around quite ineffectively, as he often does. And it looked like they weren't going to get there. And then Malo Gusto puts in a cross. And poor old Kieran Trippier.
Poor old Kieran
come
Trippier.
On at half-time. Difficult cross to defend in that it bounces just in front of him, zips off the turf, and he seems to be caught in two minds. It looks like he's trying to head it back to Dubravka, but ends up just sort of like
cushioning
the ball straight into Mudrick's path.
The box is full of attacking players. Why would you head it back towards goal?
I mean, there was, you could see what he was trying to do, but, and you know, Mudrick didn't attack the ball. Mudrick was just kind of like idling on the edge of the penalty area, looking a bit dazed. And Trippier sort of messes up. And having also been at fault for the two goals that condemned Newcastle to defeat at Everton recently.
He's having a worse December than Ipswich in 1963.
He is. And I wonder whether it's sort of, I don't know, whether it's kind of mental fatigue or something. Because Newcastle have been down to the bare bones for a while now. They've had the Champions League to contend with, obviously midweek League Cup fixture, so many injuries. They do just look like they could do with a bit of a rest. It goes to penalties. Chelsea take four exceptional penalties. Trippier misses his. And then Matt Ritchie's penalty is saved and Chelsea go through. And it felt like quite a big result for Chelsea in that they were on the cusp of going out, hadn't really created anything, you know, managed to find a way to go through. And the stadium is absolutely bouncing at the end. And you look at them all celebrating and you realise what a young group this Chelsea team is and how important, you know, results like that
It was fairly sterile from Chelsea. I mean, they had 861 passes for four shots on target, which is not the golden ratio. But like you say, it could be a turning point. There were scenes, but they still look a massive work in progress.
You can always tell how important the victory is by how they celebrate a penalty shootout. Because if it's the full sprint and pylon for like a cup final, or if it's like a pre-season tournament or something, it's just high fives and they sort of, shall we celebrate or not? This was somewhere in the middle, but it was quite joyous.
Also, the fan bursting onto the field after the equaliser to bounce off Dubravka in scenes that are even now being reviewed by the Metropolitan Police. But yeah, spoke of the raw enthusiasm and passion.
And it was quite a bad-tempered game and there was no VAR. Which, you know, we're not really used to.
Well, you said that Anthony Gordon limped off. He limped off after a pretty horrendous tackle.
A good old-fashioned Achilles tendon gouging by Caicedo within like the third minute. And Levi Colwill got away with one on Emil Kraft as well. So there was a bit of Christmas needle.
I see. Newcastle this weekend will be away at Luton. Luton, whose week has been very much focused on how their skipper Tom Lockyer is getting on after last week's events. Other games going to penalties midweek. Well, there was Everton-Fulham. Fulham winning that one 7-6 on penalties. The goals, 1-1 it had finished at the end of the 90. Keane with the own goal early on. And then Better, who came on, took it to penalties. And there was the moment when Everton could have sealed it quite early on in the shootout. Amadou Inanna, the jauntiest approach ever to a potentially game-winning spot kick, I would suggest.
Inanna steps up. Oh, lovely save. It was weak. It was really weak from Inanna. And Bernd Leno went down and made the save. Comfortable save, because he really didn't get hold of that at all. That's poor.
Kind of looked like he wanted to do one of those penalties where you wait for the keeper to move and then put it the other way, but just got it very badly wrong.
I mean,
and it's kind of the new, it's almost like the Panenka. That's like proper football people didn't like players missing Panenkas because it's unnecessarily fancy. Just bloody put your laces through it, you idiot. And the kind of the jaunty sort of stop start tiptoe penalty run up.
But he skips with his hands in the air as though he's exited a chorus line only moments before. It's a curious,
yeah, very two Ronnie's Christmas special, isn't it?
Very, or possibly even Morecambe and Wise closing credits.
I mean, it was, you can't say run up because it was a step and a skip. Really,
I mean, I think Jorginho said that if you do the skip, you have to put it in the corner.
Yeah, and it's almost down the middle, you know.
Well, because you need to score the penalty. But why
the corner?
Because if you do the skip, it tends to be quite a low speed penalty, and if you put that in the middle, you know, the keeper can even recover. I mean, it was, and for a club like Everton, who haven't won a trophy since Sean Dyche was 23, this was a real chance at least get to a semi, and it's gone.
It's the clubs who want it the most, Everton and Newcastle, just never quite get there. And Newcastle's trophy drought is, what, more than half a century now?
Yeah, the first cup.
Unless you count the first
95? 90?
The domestic trophy was...
Oh, did you say Newcastle? Sorry.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
Yeah, domestic trophy was 50, isn't it? They won like...
Yeah, well, what was it? The Intercity...
Fairs Cup.
Yeah.
Which is they, just
they
like... They
won the Intertoto. How old was Sean Dyche when that happened? That's the question.
Intertoto does not count, Tom. It might do in France, but not...
No, I'm not saying it does. I'm just saying it is a trophy.
Of course, in France, you don't even have a League Cup, do you?
Coupe de la Ligue.
No.
Mort,
it's gone.
As they say.
It's been shot.
But we should say congrats to Fulham. That's the first time they've ever reached the League Cup semis.
Yeah, celebrations from the cottages. Wow.
Mm.
Not the first Newcastle time I've seen cottages piling. No.
Sorry, Newcastle won the Intertoto Cup in 2006. And whereas in previous years, they'd always been combined winners... In 2006, Newcastle were outright winners.
Right.
So,
Fulham through to their first winners. Ever League Cup semi, and this done without Raúl Jiménez as well.
They're having a good. They're sort of reverting to last season's mean, really.
Mm.
Silva's doing a good job, but you know, him, Mitrovic, and Palhinha are probably the three key players to last season. Mitrovic left. Silva came very close to leaving, and Palhinha. Basically left.
Went 10 minutes from leaving, pretty much.
Yeah. And then they had some injuries as well. So I feel like, you know, they've got over that now and they're sort of reverting back to last season.
I mean, they had a very unsettled end to August.
Yeah, but they're like a BTEC Brighton. You know, they're stylish, good to watch.
BTEC Brighton. Harsh, Tim. What's the feeling now that the January window is creaking open again about Palhinha? Will he be off, do you think?
I mean, he seemed absolutely... He had to miss a match because he was so distraught about not going.
Mm. By a minute, I think, certainly still be interested.
I think there'd be other teams interested as well now.
Mm. But with a potential carrot of a Wembley final to look forward to.
Yeah.
Might that be enough if
they draw Middlesbrough in the semis, then... You know.
And he's you know, in last couple of weeks, he's been forming a new look... midfield partnership with Tom Cairney, who habitually plays a little bit further forward. And there is something very, very sort of fluid, very watchable about the football that Fulham play. And you get the feeling that, I mean, yeah, when you're sort of racking up 5-0 wins, must be quite an enjoyable thing to be a part of. So perhaps Palhinha isn't yet, you know, getting measurements for his Lederhosen.
I see. All
good news for when the Fulham's new stand eventually opens in 2038.
So. Is it still not open?
It's still not open. The slowest opening building since the Parthenon. I don't know. Maybe.
Fulham this weekend are facing Burnley, as we mentioned, and will be scoring 10 goals at least, by our estimates, which will make it a busy afternoon for Rebecca Welsh, who will be in charge. She'll be the first female referee for a Premier League fixture ever. Duncan, you've seen her in action very recently, no?
Yeah, she was the referee for Derby v Wickham last weekend.
Okay, how'd that go?
She was really good. I mean, she gave Wickham a 97th minute penalty, so, I mean, I wasn't averse to that. But yeah, did really well. In quite a bad tempered game at points. So yeah, it's a landmark moment.
Okay. Also in the League Cup midweek, well, Liverpool West Ham is going to happen tonight, so can't really say too much about that. Unless you want to hazard a guess, Tim.
Liverpool at home.
Yes.
I think West Ham will win.
Oh, all right. And then we'll have the draw and all that. And it's a draw that will feature Michael Carrick's Borough, who thumped Port Vale 3-0 on Tuesday. They didn't need a penalty shootout. No siree, Bob.
From the Wembley of the North to possibly the Wembley of the Wembley.
Bingo. Hmm. Is Borough known as the Wembley of the North?
No, Port Vale's ground was known as Wembley of the North.
Was it? Yeah. Why is that?
Why?
Because when it opened, it had a very big pitch and people were like, oh, it's like Wembley.
I mean,
tenuous, yeah, but very true.
All right, well, let's move on and let's talk about how Everton picked themselves up from that Fulham defeat away at Spurs and other Premier League things.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show with James Richardson, the Football Content Awards International Podcast of the Year.
Brentford, not in action this weekend because Man City are off. So there'll be none of that touchline tension and the other excitements that we had last weekend in the game with Villa. Apropos of which, The Totally Football Show, which as you know is sponsored by Google Pixel, had The Athletic's Jay Harris there. And here he is now going beyond the frame.
Beyond the Frame with Google Pixel.
Everything you're about to hear has been recorded using Google Pixel's Audio Magic Eraser tool. That means that instead of our journalists' audio being drowned out by the crowd, the audio sounds just the way the journalist you're about to hear wants you to. You'll hear them loud and clear thanks to Audio Magic Eraser removing distracting sounds in Beyond the Frame.
Requires Google Photos app. May not work on all images or all audio elements.
The chaotic ending to Brentford's 2-1 defeat to Aston Villa on Sunday afternoon at the GTEC Community Stadium has quite unfairly stolen some of the limelight away from Keane Lewis Potter, who finally scored his first Premier League goal for the club. It's been a strange 18 months for Keane Lewis Potter ever since he joined Brentford in July 2022 for what was a then club record fee of £16 million. Due to form and fitness, you know, he's had quite a few ankle and knee injuries. It's just not quite worked out for him yet. But with Brian and Mbeumo out injured for 3 months, Johan Visser off to AFCON in January, this feels like the opportunity for Keane Lewis Potter to get a regular run of games in the side and show everybody what he can do. Now, the plan was for him to strut his stuff against Sheffield United last week, but that didn't exactly go according to plan as Brentford lost 1-0. Against Aston Villa, the in-form Aston Villa who'd beaten Arsenal and Man City, felt like it'd be a much trickier occasion for him to show his stuff. But that's exactly what he did. He nipped in front of Alex Moreno and scored a great goal, which put Brentford 1-0 up. But even apart from that, it was his desire to run in behind, to make tackles. You know, he was hunting down Emi Martinez at one point in the first half. They're those moments that will really stand out to Thomas Frank and show that hopefully he's got a bright future ahead.
Beyond the Frame with Google Pixel.
Oh, if it's on-field nastiness that you're after, then you can't say fairer than Turkey, where regrettably everything was suspended a week or two back after the Ankara Gücü president stormed onto the pitch to spit at a referee, which is fair enough, but instead crossed the line and punched him in the head instead. And yeah, anyway, but they brought football back and thankfully nothing like that Ankara Gücü stuff happened. Instead, the Istanbulspor president stormed onto the pitch mid-game and took his team off in protest at the refereeing decision. So, progress. Yeah. Oh, Tim, you were in Zagreb last weekend to see big Croatian game between Dinamo Zagreb and Hajduk Split. How'd that go?
Awful game.
Oh, really?
So no team had had a shot by the 28th minute.
Okay.
I was like, I was just watching the stands, basically. It was far more entertaining.
I bet that was entertaining.
Rowdy.
The Bad Blue Boys.
The Bad Blue Boys, named after...
Chelsea.
Named after, I've not seen it, but the 1983 hit film starring Sean Penn called Bad Boys, apparently.
Right, well, Bad Boys. That's not Sean Penn, is it? That's your Will Smith.
That's another one altogether.
Oh, there's one with Sean Penn, is there? Producer Charlie's giving you the nod. Thanks,
yes.
Charlie.
Oh, yeah. I've never heard of that.
I don't know what that. What happens in that film?
Bad stuff.
Really?
Boys-related activities and shenanigans, basically, starring Sean Penn from 1983.
Speaking of things getting slightly lost in translation with Eastern European ultras, I think I was in Montenegro for an England qualifier ages ago, and I remember seeing some graffiti on a wall that just said "Always Ultra," in an unwitting reference to the popular range of women's sanitary products. But it was not in reference to that. It was in reference to being an ultra, forever.
Yeah. Wow. There you go. There you go. How did it finish between Hajduk Split and Partizan Zagreb? Dinamo Zagreb.
Dinamo Zagreb, Hajduk Split. Finished 0-0. It was terrible.
Why were you there?
So this is the Athletic's Derby Day series. Several of us have gone around Europe to the most sort of bitter, fierce rivalries. And it was a really interesting trip. It is, if you're interested in Croatian football, Duncan's nodding along. Dinamo have won the league every year since 2005, bar one. And Hajduk are top this year by 6 points.
Ooh.
So they've finally got something to cling on to, which is why they came for a 0-0 draw. But yeah, it was much more entertaining in the stands. The game had to stop a couple of times for stuff being lobbed onto the field.
Oh, really?
And I was grateful for the fire and the flares because it was absolutely freezing. There's no roof in this stadium and there's no corners, and it was like below freezing. So yeah, but it was an awful game. Much more interesting in the stands. But read all about it on The Athletic.
Nice. Very good. Now, the Premier League weekend continues with Spurs against Everton. That's Saturday, 3 o'clock. Tim, you're going along to that. Should be a good one.
I think so. Yeah, given Everton's sort of away record and Spurs have clicked into gear again, they've got this weird thing where they 10 unbeaten to start the season, then lost 4 out of 5. And now they feel like they're picking up a bit of momentum again. A couple of good victories and they're sort of bubbling below the top four at the moment. But they've got Everton, Brighton and Bournemouth over Christmas. So, and players returning soon, Madison and Van de Ven. So I think they're back in a good place again.
They're on the Opta prediction model. Spurs are favourites to come fifth, which, as we know, may well have a Champions League spot this season.
According to Opta, it will, yeah. They also predict England to roar back from
it's
outside.
It's a very patriotic computer.
There. Yeah. England currently outside the extra place for your team's
narrowly,
zone. But according to Opta, they'll be top by the end of the season, which is, when it counts, I guess. Spurs against Everton will be a big game for Richarlison, who's suddenly hit form. 3 goals in 2 games.
Yeah, which makes such a big difference. Spurs have got a front four at the moment, which is pretty exciting to watch, with Son on the left, Brennan Johnson on the right, and now Kulusevski's in this sort of number 10 role. They've finally worked out how to sort of replace Madison's creativity in the team, and they look really good for it. But they are missing Bissouma and Udogie, who were suspended this weekend. So,
thing to look out for in this game.
Yes.
We did a piece on The Athletic a few weeks ago by Tom Harris about turning teams round at home. But going through the data, discovered that Sean Dyche absolutely loves doing it. Like, basically at kickoff, making the home team attack the end, they like to attack in the second half. Home, and that's how they did it with Forest of the day. They've done it. Basically, Dyche has done it in like 12 of his last 17 away games.
Right.
Classic Dyche.
I'm confused though. So
Liverpool like attacking the cop in the second half, but United did it to them last weekend. So Liverpool attacked the cop in the first half. And,
by winning the toss?
You can either win the toss and choose to do it, or the home team can say, we want to take the kickoff, and that gives the away team the chance to turn them around. So it does feel like teams are cutting onto it a bit more this season. It feels like it's a growing scene.
Why does it make a difference?
Well, psychologically, it's kind of historically been seen as a thing. So, I'm pretty sure that Dyche will try and do it at Spurs.
Something to watch. Coin toss.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like most teams, if not all teams, have like a preferred end. Newcastle attacking the Gallagher end, Stratford United end, attacking the Stratford end and all that.
Do you want to have that advantage to get the game heading in your direction, or do you want it there as a kind of fallback
match,
in the
match going half? Fans get really annoyed, particularly if you're behind that goal, if it gets, because football's all about routine and, you know, that sort of thing. And it is, I saw Liverpool fans last week saying, oh, well, we had to attack the cop in the first half. That was when we knew the game was going to be bad. So obviously Spurs have got a very big, noisy home end. So Dyche will be planning.
Already. I didn't think my respect for Sean Dyche could get any higher. it just did.
But does that mean that the Everton captain is winning the toss?
Well, I think
what do captains tend to do? They go for the kickoff or they switch the edge?
I think recently a lot of captains just go, well, we'll just kick off, or, you know. But I think this
thing,
Dyche
is, they used to.
I mean, we actually spoke to Sam Vokes, who, you know, used to play under Dyche at Burnley, and said that it was, it's definitely something that Sean... It's pure Dutch, isn't it? Pure, like...
weaponising the toss. It feels quite Sam Allardyce in a way.
Yeah.
It's like, where can we find advantages?
It seems to be working. Obviously, Everton's away form recently has been great. And they, I think in most of their wins away from home, they have turned the teams around. So and it's definitely...
Turned the teams around.
And the toss isn't yet an event. It's one of the
yeah,
few,
like, in
pieces
American football
of the sort of pre-match... ceremonials that has no real focus on. Whereas if the word gets out, you might get people. Ooh.
Oh, I didn't realize until researching this piece that it's actually got, it's sponsored, right? Hublo. It's called the Hublo coin toss in
is
the
it?
Premier League.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
So I think we need to. This is the. We need to start making this a big thing.
People must be kicking themselves.
We need to talk more toss.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're way ahead of the game on this podcast, of course. Very good. Wow. Will the Toffees pick up their fifth away victory in a row? We shall see. A little bit earlier on Saturday, you got another very big game. West Ham, again, they're in action Wednesday night, away at Liverpool, victorious in Tim Spears' prediction in that match. But taking on Man United Saturday lunchtime, that's at home, where Mo Kudus is in exceptional form. 4 goals in his last 3 matches there. United will have Bruno Fernandes back from suspension. Should be a lively one, this, because only 2 teams in the Premier League have conceded more shots than these 2 lineups. West Ham and Man United are allowing so many chances. The 2 teams that have conceded more, you won't be amazed here, are Luton and Sheffield United. Tom, you're looking like you want to opine.
Yeah, I think this is potentially a very tricky game for Manchester United, who felt like they'd... I mean, we say quite a lot that Man United have stopped the rot when they get a half-decent result, which a 0-0 draw at Anfield in the circumstances in which it was played probably is, only for the rot to then set in immediately in their next game. But that the result at Anfield did buy them a little bit of breathing room off the back of that home defeat by Bournemouth. But West Ham in terrific form at the moment. Thought the way they set up against Wolves was really interesting, with Jared Bowen as sort of like a false nine, Kudus cutting in from the right hand side, Lucas Paquetá sort of threading passes through from, you know, from central midfield, and you get the sense that, you know, there all of those players are on the same wavelength, and they're also one of the best counter-attacking teams in the country. Man United will expect to have possession. They're still sort of not labouring under a misapprehension, but, you know, Manchester United are supposed to be a possession team, so they still try and play out from the back as far as possible, and, you know, they still try and dominate their opponents. And West Ham are very good at playing against teams like that, particularly teams like that don't really know what they're doing, which is basically what Manchester United are. So,
and of course, for David Moyes, so significant, this fixture.
So significant, yeah. Mm. Particularly given his less than stellar record against all the, you know, the leading lights in the
Could
in,
this be,
in the division.
Do you think, the game when that long...
Well, that's, no, that's away from home.
Oh, dear. Okay. But, all right, then. Yeah.
So, yeah, I think it's not a great time to be playing West Ham for Man United.
Indeed not.
During the season.
During the season, basically. Any time between August and May.
Yeah, it's tricky.
A bad time.
Club World Cup, for example, next year. Bingo. Excellent. The other game this weekend, I haven't mentioned it yet, it's Crystal Palace against Brighton. Bitter rivalry itself, of course.
Don't mention the road.
Last 4 meetings between these 2 teams at Selhurst Park have all ended by what scoreline, Duncan?
0-0.
No, 1-1.
Oh.
There you go, 1-1.
I was getting confused. There was a heinous VAR error in this game last season.
Was there?
Brighton got an apology.
Oh, the offside. Yeah, that was bad.
Against Palace.
Yeah. Well, Palace benefited.
Palace benefited, did they? Okay. Palace haven't won at home in over three months since the 3rd of September. Crikey.
But yeah, it should be, you know, I like this game. I like this fixture. It's a low-key kind of feisty little affair.
Mm. And a clash of styles as well. Mm. Hodgson against De Zerbi. Mm. And they're not particularly similar football philosophies.
Well, if you say De Zerbi has a Pep-like, you know, freewheeling attitude to formations, and we all saw the clip of Hodgson laughing, chuckling away against Pep last weekend.
Yeah, that's true.
Could be again in the what fans are calling the Peace Pottage Classico.
Is that what they're calling it?
Well, they don't like the M23 derby, so I've been trying to think of other Derby de Three Bridges. The Gatwick Cup.
What was the Peace? I don't know. What's Peace Pottage?
That's the service station on the M23. So it needs a name, this fixture. So
yeah, every fixture needs a name. Anyway, that's what's happening before Christmas, and then as soon as Christmas is done, boom, you got another full set of fixtures, then another. We, as I say, not going to be back for any of it. It really is shocking. I'm awfully sorry. I'll be off doing World's Strongest Man, of course. So there's that. But in terms of things that are going to happen, is there anything that we can preemptively get the listener stocked up on in terms of analysis? Do you want to do a bit on Fulham beating Burnley 10-0?
Well, I've already mentioned that. I think the 10 is going to drop this Christmas at some point.
How significant do you feel that is? Has Vincent Kompany been sacked as a result? And do you think that's the right decision?
He won't get sacked for that, no. Okay. The process continues.
All right. Yeah. Any long life punditry that we can stock the listeners' mental cupboard with, Tom?
So my prediction is that Ineos will complete their takeover of Manchester United. That will be announced.
Oh, really? You think that's going to happen?
I think that's going to happen. And that on day one, Dave Brailsford will begin an audit of the club, which is what he did when he took over at Nice.
Right.
And he will discover, to his horror, that every major strategic decision that has been taken over the previous 10 years has been taken by shaking a magic eight ball that was gifted to the club by the Glazer family
right
in 2013. And that will be the first step on, you know, the Ineos pathway to glory. We'll be ditching the magic eight ball.
Ditching the magic eight ball? Mm. I'd feel very, very uncomfortable about ditching anything with mystic powers like that.
Well,
wow.
Watch this space.
Yeah. And do you think actual human-based decision-making will fare better for Man
United? Actually, no. I think what will happen is things will not improve.
Right.
I think United will have the most calamitous January transfer window imaginable.
Uh-huh.
I think
involving who, Tom, will dive. Since we're here?
Well, they'll sell all their most important players without replacing them.
All right.
They'll buy duds who are so bad that they make Antony look like the second coming of Rivaldo.
I thought they weren't going to use the magic eight ball anymore.
This is without the magic eight ball's assistance.
Right.
They'll start sliding down the table, defeat after defeat after defeat. Ten Hag will be sacked. Ralph Rangnick will be brought back in.
Right.
He'll be
Is this
sacked.
All before the 2nd of January when we return?
Yeah, all being crammed in. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer will come in a managerial partnership with a hologram of Billy Meredith.
Wow.
On a sort of gets the club dream ticket.
Yeah.
That won't work either.
Oh.
And it will become apparent before the end of the season, I'm squeezing quite a lot in here, that actually the only entity at the club that was keeping things on an even tiller was the Magic 8-Ball. So it'll be fished out of the bin. United will avoid relegation by the skin of their teeth.
Right.
But they'll be basically back where
they started. Your job now is to get behind the Magic 8-Ball.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, you can imagine the memes.
Mm. Mm. Blimey.
Wow.
How'd you follow that?
I don't know.
Well, one thing they always do in January is sign a non-goal-scoring striker. So it's about Weghorst. Last January?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Igalo a couple of years earlier.
Oh, good Lord, yeah.
I predicted in August that it would be Chris Wood, who wouldn't be able to get into Forest's expanded squad and would be released and picked up by Man United, which I still think is possible, but unlikely.
Okay.
But yeah, apart from that, everything Tom said, really.
Everything Tom said. Magnificent. I could offer a prediction as to who's going to win World's Strongest Man, because I've got a sneaky feeling I might know that. But what I can tell you...
Was it a beefcake?
Wait, what do you mean, was?
Is it a beefcake?
Is it a beefcake? It's an extraordinary road to that title. Twists and turns.
Not when they're pulling the thing, do they?
No. Well, there are some twists. Yeah, extraordinary story of human strength and endeavour.
The greatest strength is in the mind.
Well, and you know what?
Not when you're trying to pick up
the biggest
truck.
Muscle of all.
I thought it was the thigh.
Anyway, that'll be on Channel 5, since you wanted to know.
It is an enjoyable Christmas tradition.
I like it. Yeah. Not sure when. Probably starting the actual World's Strongest Man, I think, on Boxing Day. Mm. Usually climaxes on New Year's Day, just ahead of our return. We can maybe analyse that. I've talked too much about it, though, so I'm going to stop. Tim, have a great Christmas.
And you.
Thank you very much. And you, Tom Williams.
Thank you, James. And you,
Duncan Alexandra.
Likewise.
Yes. And listener, especially you. And we will return on the 2nd of January. So I can only hope that you have a super time and really enjoy your football, whatever it may bring, between now and then. From all of us here at Team Totally, it's a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Discover bonus video content by searching for The Totally Football Show on YouTube and see the very latest subscription offers at theathletic.com/totally.
The Athletic.